From KPFK in Los Angeles, California, Valley Free Radio in Florence, and WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WNUC in Detroit, and BikeTalk.org worldwide, this is Bike Talk.
Bike Talk.
Welcome to Bike Talk. I'm Taylor Nichols.
I'm Nick Richard.
I'm Anne-Marie Drolet.
I just got back from assignment in Park City, Utah, where we talked a lot about winter bike riding and also a little bit of skiing. And on my way back, I stopped at the Zion National Park, and they have a light-sensitive area there where they don't have outdoor lights. And it's absolutely gorgeous. You can really see the night sky. And it made me think of some listener email that we got from Jonathan Weiss. You want to read that? Because Jonathan is a Los Angeles bike advocate, and he was the representative for Council District 5 to the Los Angeles Bicycle Advisory Committee, and he wrote us this email.
So Jonathan says, I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed Bike Talk becoming part of my Thursday morning routine as I ride to Coldwater and Mulholland. There are no accidents. Author Jesse Singer essentially said that our cohort countries differ only in infrastructure. I think she used Norway as an example. I wanted to point out what some of my European friends have told me. It is much harder to get and keep a driver's license abroad. Maybe that helps make those countries safer for people outside of cars. I don't know, but I thought I'd put it out there. According to the International Driving Authority, getting a driver's license in Norway is long, expensive, and cumbersome. Wikipedia says, in Norway, it is not unusual to end up paying $25,000 to $35,000 NOK, $4,000 US, for a driving license. This is owing to the vast number of courses required. Keep up the good work.
You know, I just love that message because as I was driving through the West on our little road trip, it made me realize how we have this infrastructure that supports only cars. And so therefore, in the United States, we have to make it easy to get a driver's license.
Anybody can get a driver's license. That means that you need to be seen by just anybody. You have to be conscious of who's out there on the roads.
Because some of our drivers are not that skilled at actually driving. And we talk about this all the time, Nick, about what is the responsibility of the vulnerable road user. Of course, we think that the roads should be built safely. As Jesse Singer said in the interview a couple of weeks ago, we have to make the roads safe for drunk drivers. But since we don't, there is a certain amount of obligation for your own safety to be lit up. And that brings in our special guest today, Nick and Anne-Marie, Rio Ramsey from Detroit, Michigan. Rio, welcome to Bike Talk.
What up, though, y'all?
It's good to have you back on the show, man.
Happy New Year, everybody. I'm grateful to be here.
Happy New Year, I guess, because we haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah, it's been a nice little minute.
You're in the bike light business, correct?
Yes.
If we want to be seen by the people who are out there on the roads at night driving, what would you recommend?
The main light that me and my team been using lately, we've been using the Rock Bros Smart Turn Signal. And it's like an all-in-one specialty light. It has, obviously, turn signals, has an automatic brake light, and it comes with a remote. And it also has a laser lane that you can turn on, and it gives you about 3 feet on both sides a lane, because in Michigan, cars have to give you at least 3 feet while you're cycling on the road. So my entire team is going to have them, and I will have them available come bike season.
So this is a light that shows a marking on the pavement behind you that is 3 feet from your bike so that cars approaching you at night can see how much space they should give.
It gives you like an artificial lane about the size of a bike lane. So I wouldn't literally say 3 feet on both sides, but it's visible enough to where somebody can see you coming from behind. And then because of the size and the brightness of the taillight, if they hit you with this on, they did it on purpose.
That's great. Does the light charge by batteries or is it a USB charger?
It's USB. The charging time was 3 to 5 hours. It clips right off and it comes with a little remote. You can go right on your handlebars. And what I like it the most for is because it has a brake light, because most bike lights in general do not have a brake light.
How does a brake light on a bicycle work?
That's some type of programming where it responds to the remote. So when you're slowing down, just like when you're hitting your brakes in a car, as you're decelerating, it's mimicking a brake light.
Well, in the middle of Utah at night, that would be really fantastic. But in the middle of Los Angeles or Detroit or any other major city where you need to be seen at night, I can see how that would be really helpful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks, Rio. And you want to just give us a quick update on any rides coming up in Detroit?
You know, since February, it's been like a few days with 70 degrees. So I've been putting some initiative in to host rides, showcasing the Joe Louis Greenway, as we've talked about on previous interviews. And the Joe Louis Greenway is a 27-mile greenway that they're building in Detroit. It's a network that's going to be connecting in different sections in Detroit. So we've been showcasing that. And I have a ride coming up of my club, Motown Trailblazers, May 5th. Pushing Pedal Sundays, we're meeting up to showcase the Joe Louis Greenway. It's going to be our second annual Joe Louis Greenway rat. We're going to have a free taco bar, free nacho bar. We're just going to get some good miles in and stuff like that.
That sounds great. I love tacos.
Oh, that ride sounds really awesome. I want to go.
Come on down to Detroit.
Rio Ramsey from Detroit, Michigan. Later in the show, we have an interview with author Ellie Blue, but we're also going to do the second part of the interview with Charles Marone from Strong Towns. We got some listener email from the first part of the interview last week. And Nick, you want to read that?
This is Jonathan Levin in Northampton, Massachusetts.
That's your neighborhood, right?
It sure is. He wrote, "Thank you so much for having Charles Marone on your program. It takes a lot of integrity to create a conversation that gives such space to someone who has, in many ways, a quite different take on the issue of biking, cars, traffic, crazy big SUVs than you seem to. I love that your show exists, that you advocate for bikes, bikers, and biking, and for the redesign of the artery system to provide for safe conduct for bikes. I love that you have geographical variety. I do not love what I've come to experience as your self-righteousness about bikers. Indeed, your disdain for drivers and others." And here he has an asterisk, and down below it says, "I've seen bikers act just as badly as drivers do, with as little care or awareness of others, for instance, pedestrians, in many other ways, which I will spare you my litany about. I do believe that shaming does not bring about change in others. I'm a psychotherapist, so I'm superficially informed about this. How does shaming work with you when you're shamed? Most of us become defensive, and not in a healthy way, and that sort of defensiveness mostly results in intransigence. I hear Marone encouraging a change in the perception of drivers. They are not an enemy. They are as much captive to the traffic, okay, let's be honest, to the late capitalist system, as you are. It's fun to ridicule, but it's not a great mechanism for social change. Take care, Jonathan P. Levin, Northampton, Massachusetts."
You know, Nick, this is something that we talk about a lot. We have so much more in common than we do not in common. We all want safe streets, and we all want the ability for people to choose which mode of transportation suits their needs.
And Strong Towns has been great on that. They take a different approach. You know, I mean, we would like some regulation about speed and cars. You know, they can make speed limiters or car size, you know, so you don't have these monster vehicles on our roads.
And the USS Nimitz, right?
Battleships on wheels. It's great that we can find out what we agree on.
I have to take issue with what he said about, "I've seen bikers act just as badly as drivers do, with little care or awareness of others." The only difference is when you're on a bike and you show indifference toward others, you're going 12 miles an hour on a bicycle and not 30 miles an hour in an SUV, and you don't kill people.
Generally not.
I would say I'm much more anti-car than I am anti-driver.
You see a difference in the two.
I do. Yeah. I think, you know, car culture is the thing that's killing us. And, you know, obviously someone is driving the car, but I think that's where the empathy comes in. We're all humans.
Right.
But we're not all cars. I don't know.
Do you drive a car, Anne-Marie?
I will occasionally borrow my partner's truck, but I don't own a car and I hate driving.
Yeah. Charles says, you know, driving in America sucks. And so we have a lot in common.
Well, this goes back to how we started the show, right, Nick? We have this built environment that forces people to drive. So therefore, we have to make getting a driver's license fairly easy to get. And that's why we need people like Rio Ramsey, who has bike lights to keep us safe on the road.
We need lights to keep us safe because we don't have roads doing it.
Exactly.
Let's go to part two of the Charles Marone interview with Stacey Rennick.
Great.
I actually think we have way more power and way more authority than we think. And I want to see cities, local governments orient around the needs of people in their community and use a big expanded toolbox to do beautiful, wonderful things that would include making streets way safer for everybody.
I'm very focused on climate and how we are failing, how the United States is the problem, how our automotive oil-based nation is really causing things on a global scale. And then the intersection with, we feel it every day in our towns and our cities. I don't think that there is any one thing that can solve climate change. I don't think that there is any one thing that is the magic bullet for Vision Zero or just having a better functioning, healthier way of moving, less dangerous way. But it is a multitude of things, and we must have all of them working. So to say that NHTSA won't solve it, vehicle size alone is not the answer. We certainly had mounting traffic deaths before these bloated land crawler mobiles and whatever. Yeah. The safest car when I was growing up was a Volvo. That's what you put your family in. And at that time, Volvo didn't have anything that stood over the height of an average adult. They were all sedans, and they were absolutely the safest cars on the road. So the idea that you have to have this ever escalating obese mobile, I do think that that's an issue.
Our peer nations don't have the same kind of traffic deaths that we have. And we have a different relationship to regulation. And like you see it with guns. I mean, isn't there a pretty strong argument for how regulation does affect traffic deaths?
See, I feel like we have way more regulation in a lot of ways. If you go to, you know, Western Europe and you look around, you don't see very many large vehicles. And you're like, well, okay, well, these people are smarter, more civilized, more decent, more moral. You could ascribe all those things if you wanted. I think the more practical reason is that it would be dumb to drive a big car because the streets are narrow and you can't drive fast. And if you have a big car, there's no place to park it and you can't get around. If you come over here and you look and you say, why don't people drive small cars? Well, we have spent 80 years widening streets, widening, like, providing parking spaces, obsessing about commuters, denuding our neighborhoods in order to accommodate really, really large vehicles. And, you know, efficient economies. So efficient economies mean putting stuff on big trucks and hauling it around. When you do that, there's a certain defensive mission creep that happens within every household that allows these kind of larger trucks to become the not just accommodated, but then once it's accommodated, like the preferred option. That's not really a regulatory thing at all. I mean, Europe has not mandated narrow streets. They have a different design ethic. They have a different design approach. They build their cities differently. You know, we have a lot of regulations on how you must build a street. We have a lot of regulations on how you must design something. And it forces us to go in the wrong direction. I actually think if we got rid of a lot of those, our local engineers, our local transportation officials would find it much easier to do their job. So many of them will say, you know, and I think this was part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission a concept. So many of them will say, well, I was just following the rules. I was just following the standards as they were laid out for me. I was just following what everybody else did. I was just copying the last engineer who did this. And a lot of that institutional inertia is what keeps us from doing, I think, things that would have a bigger impact more quickly.
But, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I get to ask you this.
Yeah.
Why do they do it? Why do they follow something that is so broken? Why are we still hiring or requiring, you know, education or certification for transportation planners? Because it's all wrong. And so if this is the test you've been trained to, this is what we're getting in our cities. And I argue that, you know, we advocates, we could build a much more effective transportation system than the ones who've gone to school for it.
Yes.
Why don't they do it differently?
Well, I wrote a whole book about this. Confessions of a Recovering Engineer is designed to say, like, here's how it's all wrong and here's why we've done it wrong and here's how we do it differently. And so, yeah, there's a large institutional problem. I think if we understand engineers, and this is why I think Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as opposed to, you know, literally the Hague, where we take people out and hang them for their war crimes. You know, South Africa is a better model. It's like, let's come forth and talk about the bad things we did so that we can forgive each other and move on. But let's face it, let's be honest about it. The reality is that the traffic engineering profession, the modern one, inherited standards that were developed right after World War II to build interstates across North America. And if you go back to that period of time and you are generous to the people who were there, which I think we should always be generous to people of the past, because we are very flawed humans like they were, they were trying really hard to stay out of a second Great Depression. You know, they ended this war, they demobilized all these troops, they shut down all these industries. And by all accounts, every economist thought, we're just going to go right back into the depths of the Depression. And instead, what we did is we embarked on this massive building movement to build interstates, build frontage roads, build interchanges, create suburbs, build housing, fill that housing full of consumer goods. We created an economy based around cities that would grow. And engineers and planners, quite frankly, but traffic engineers in specific, spent that time learning how to do that well. And they embodied that as kind of like the commandments they received on stone tablets. Like, this is the gospel according to the people who originated this. Remember, the engineering profession is thousands of years old. The traffic engineering profession is like 2.5 generations old. I mean, it's really, really young. The body of knowledge, the wisdom that is very, very young wisdom. But it is treated as if it was given to us by Moses. It's like, here's the book. Here's what you follow. You add into that a certain amount of power that is ingrained in having a set of standards that you can apply. And then you add into that the fact that lots and lots of money allows us to be stupid for a long period of time. In other words, if you can overcome all of your problems by getting another federal appropriation, another state appropriation, another bond issue that you float, you know, another assessment that you do, you don't have to actually reconcile with the impacts of your stuff if you have lots and lots of money flowing through. And every time our economy sputters, every time we have difficulty, what do? We pour more money into transportation, more money into infrastructure, and we allow these professions to not adapt, to basically continue to be dumb. I wish that the traffic engineering profession had run out of money 40 years ago, because if they had, we would have beautiful highways, we'd have beautiful local streets, and we could afford to maintain them, and we'd have great places. It's the fact that we could continue to fund stupidity over and over and over again, and that we did at like huge volumes of cash, that has allowed it to persist as long as it has.
Yeah, because when I look at the proposed budgets for making streets safer, or how much they say it takes to retime an intersection or get new traffic lights and whatever, and I'm like, how on earth can it cost that much?
I'll go and do it myself tomorrow, right?
You know, yeah. Well, one, build roundabouts. Yeah. Why are we insisting upon signalized intersections or instructing drivers that they will wait at stop signs? You know what I mean? And they, and yeah, yes, totally it might not be as efficient, but it will ideally be safer. Oh my gosh, many things
so you can go
change in our built environment. Yes. And they won't do the simplest of them.
I think it's very instructive to go to poorer parts of the world. I've not been to a lot of them. But I have been to, you know, parts of Southern Italy that are very, very poor. I've been to parts of Greece that are very, very poor. And you look at how they do these things, and it is less glamorous than what we do, certainly. I think American sensibilities would be offended if I said we should strive to be Southern Italy, right? But the reality is that from a functional standpoint, these places function a lot better, because they have gotten to the phase where they hack things. They're like, you know, we don't have any money, so we got to make this work. How do we hack it?
What's an example of that?
You said roundabout. Mm-hmm. Intersections where you just get rid of the traffic signal because it's dumb, and you put like a planter in the middle, and people just drive slow.
Okay.
Yeah. You're coming into the intersection. It kind of narrows down a little bit, and then you just drive slow, and you don't hit it. You try not to hit people. I've seen a lot of crashes in place like this. Southern Italy is kind of a madhouse for drivers, but it's a madhouse at low speeds, where crashes mean like you dented your door, not you ran over someone and they're under your bumper.
And how large are those vehicles?
No, they're tiny. but they're tiny. but they're tiny. And understand what I'm saying about large vehicles. I'm not suggesting that large vehicles are not a problem. I think we obsess over it. And I think there's a certain, I'm going to say like culture war, and culture war like came up in the tweet thread. There's a certain culture war aspect of the SUV driver that I think is unhealthy for us as discourse. But the reason why there's small vehicles in Italy is not because they wouldn't covet an SUV or they wouldn't drive an SUV. It's because driving SUVs in Italy would be really, really dumb. You couldn't fit down half the streets. You would not be able to find a place to park. You would be so inconvenienced by driving if you drove a large vehicle that the inconvenience that it already is would just be magnified.
So make it more inconvenient. Is that what you're saying?
If I'm running San Francisco, I'm having narrower streets. I'm having slower streets. I'm spending less money on asphalt and more money on bike walk infrastructure, trees, green space. And so, yeah, if I'm going to drive my big truck in downtown San Francisco, I'm going to find that like really, really inconvenient. That is the way if I was San Francisco, I would deal with it. That doesn't mean you won't get a big truck down there, but it's probably going to have to drive really, really slow and really, really careful. I wrote a blog post last year where I talked about we need to put in a billion bollards. Traffic engineers flip out. They hate bollards. Why? Because cars crash into them. Well, if you got a car driving 3 feet, 4 feet away from someone walking, you should have a bollard in between. And big trucks will likely hit those bollards. They will, but then they won't hit the people. And I have no problem with that. Like, I think that is actually a good outcome. People will drive slower. They will migrate to smaller vehicles. And I think that that would be like a glorious outcome of this, but it would be an outcome not through a regulatory process, which I think leaves dumb streets and dumb regulation. It would be an outcome through building great places.
What about speed limiters? I mean, we could make cars not able to go past the speed limit by more than 10 miles an hour.
Speed limiters seem like this magic amulet kind of thing that, and I'm going to stereotype here, but like progressive activists tend to love. Like, hey, can we get the federal government to step in and do this one like magic thing that will fix things? I'm going to say something that is true, and I want people to like marinate in it for a while. If you get hit by a car going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit in any neighborhood in America, you're going to be dead. So I realize like there's some victory in that the person on a 25 mile an hour street can only go 35 miles an hour and their car will like keep them from going faster than that. Fantastic. Like maybe that's a moral victory. It would come at a really super high cost. I actually don't think we would get such legislation passed, but I'm not a politician. Maybe it would. But the reality is that if you paid that price and you paid that cost, I don't think it would have any impact on death rates because you get hit by someone going 35 miles an hour and you're dead. You get hit by someone, you know, the lowest speed limit street in my city is 30 miles an hour. So you could drive 40 miles an hour through every street. Well, most streets you can't get that fast because they've got bump outs and it's tight and you can't physically do it. I don't think that that actually solves anything.
But there are places, well, especially in cities, where it would make a difference because we do have multi-lane, one-way streets. If no cars are parked on it, it's five lanes.
You have horribly designed streets. Yeah.
I agree, right. But they seem allergic to change them. So something has to change, right?
Right. I always default to the idea that if I'm going to spend energy, if Strong Towns as an organization, if our thousands of members are going to spend energy, I want them to spend energy on stuff in front of their house, up the street from them, in their community that they can do. And that toolbox is really, really large. There's a lot of things that we can do right now. I want to spend energy on that instead of supporting a mayor who will support a legislator, who will support a president, who will appoint a commissioner, who will form a committee, who will someday like reform this and that. I feel like that is how we get manipulated. And I think that's how we waste decades of our lives and get nothing done. And not, no offense against people who work on that, like fine, go do that. But I'm spending my energy on that. And I don't want to spend the energy of this movement on things like that. It's a distraction to me.
Just in reflecting upon the empathy, I understand that it is something that Strong Towns doesn't wish to spend money on. And believe me, if I could get that pill that you have seen administered in South Bend and you're advocating for, and I could give it to every city's leadership so that other towns could be this way. I'd want nothing more. It sounds wonderful. That's a place I want to be, and that's the type of things I would rather be spending time on. However, they aren't taking that and they aren't doing it with any speed, and the toll goes ever higher. So people will lash out in other directions when they see something that is a large problem. And is it okay if they do it? They still wish to fight that battle.
I feel like the most harmful myth that we have today, the one that separates us and keeps us from doing productive things in this space, in the bike walk advocacy space, is the myth that 94% of crashes are caused by driver error. When there's a crash, we send the police out and they have a checklist of things. What caused this crash? Was the person speeding? Were they wearing a seatbelt? Were they intoxicated? And we've reduced the cause of crashes down to like half a dozen different things. At Strong Towns, we created this thing called the Crash Analysis Studio, where we look at crashes and we analyze them and we look at the multiple factors that cause them. And what we find in every single one that we've ever looked at is that, yes, sometimes drivers make mistakes, but drivers are making mistakes in an environment that itself like breeds mistakes, creates mistakes. The empathy that I think we need to show is not empathy for the driver who's a jerk, who pulls up next to you and revs their engine and rides real close and yells at the window. That person is acting like a horrible person. And I'm not asking you to have empathy for them. But I do think that if we step back and look, there every single family in America, every single one, has had someone who has died in a car crash, knows someone close to them who has died in a car crash, knows someone who's been a traumatic injury in a car, has suffered a traumatic injury themselves. And the idea that that death, that violence would be reduced to some driver effed up, some driver made a mistake, as opposed to the environments that we built is violent and nasty and dehumanizing and was the primary cause of this crash. If we want to mock somebody, if we want to raise awareness, that's what we need to raise awareness of, is that the humans that we put into cars are entering spaces that are designed to be deadly. And my God, I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for their families. I feel sorry for their loved ones. I feel sorry for the people on bikes that are tormented and hit. And I feel sorry for the people biking and walking. We all share in this trauma, and we can all actually do something about it tomorrow, today, in our own cities, if we're motivated by it. So I would like to see the bike walk advocates attack that 94% number more than I want to see them shame drivers or, you know, run to the NTSB or empower some federal agency. Let's clearly like talk to each other about the fact that crashes are not driver, they're not caused by driver error. Driver error might be a contributing factor, but crashes are caused by poorly built, dangerous environments that we all live in.
I look forward to dicing this up and playing it for the SFMTA board in 2-minute increments that I'm allotted during public comment, so that maybe some of this will get in there.
Well, maybe sometime when I come to San Francisco, we can go do that together. We can show up and I'll do my 2 minutes and you can do yours, and we'll let them know we're here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a way to get in touch with Strong Towns? Do you have chapters?
Absolutely. Well, if you go to strongtowns.org/local, you'll see our local conversations. We have 200 of them across the country. I'm sure we have one in the Bay Area, but I can't promise you. I know we have a lot in California. So yeah, check that out. And strongtowns.org. I mean, all of our stuff is Creative Commons licensed, so it's free to use, free to share. You don't even have to attribute it to us. Just go out and do good things in the world.
Ryan.
Thank you.
Thanks
you
so bet. Much.
Charles makes a great point. We have to have empathy for drivers. I'm a driver. I hate driving. And every time I get behind the wheel, I change a little bit. I become angry. And that's why biking is better, because I'm not angry most of the time when I'm riding my bike.
Yeah, we have to facilitate other modes of transportation. like the listener email said, we're all captives to driving.
Which I actually wouldn't agree with. I don't feel like I am. I don't think a lot of people are actually captive to that, but many people are.
Well, that's because you don't drive very much, right, Anne-Marie?
Yeah. I mean, I don't own a car. You know, if I never had to drive again, that would be really cool.
Next up is your interview, Nick, with the author Ellie Blue.
We had Ellie Blue on probably a decade ago because she wrote Bikenomics. And she's come out with some volumes of feminist bicycle science fiction through her publishing company that she works at, Microcosm, in Portland. So great. Here's that interview.
This is Ellie Blue, the author of the seminal Bikenomics, which came out, when was that, Ellie?
That first came out in 2012, believe it or not.
I probably interviewed you around that time.
Probably, yeah. We did a new edition in 2018, and I think I've forgotten everything in it by now.
That was well received, that book.
It was. I wrote it as sort of a love letter to the bicycle activist and advocacy community. Like, I saw that a lot of people had similar struggles and similar questions, and people were really, like, come to bicycling with this, like, great sense of optimism and, like, this sense of, like, it can make your life better, it can make the planet better. And those arguments outside of kind of people who were already bought in were just falling completely flat. And so I wanted to kind of provide some more sort of economic arguments, or arguments that, like, would maybe reach a wider audience and, like, give advocates tools to make the case for change in a way that city governments could understand, or, you know, like, their family that maybe wasn't into bicycling could understand, or members of the community, business owners. I wanted to give people more arguments that were solid. And the more that I looked into it, the more I researched it, the more I was like, actually, the economic case for bicycling is excellent. Like, this is not a stretch. This is not propaganda. This really matters. And so that's why I wrote the book. And I think that it resonated with people because it was helpful, but it was also like, you know, I wasn't trying to like speak to everybody. I was trying to speak to people who already cared about bicycling and give them more tools for sharing that passion and that belief more widely.
What was the economic case for biking?
I mean, it really is honestly the economic case for bicycling and the economic case against having a car-centric society are pretty much hand in hand. Like, a bicycle happens to be like a tool that can replace a car over short or medium distances. You know, it doesn't have to run on a rail. You don't need an operator. You don't need infrastructure that's different from car infrastructure. The cost to our society and to our lives and the human cost, not just the economic cost of this car-reliant society we've built, is just staggering. You know, it's like affecting everything from like our health and safety to our civic budgets. Like, the transportation budget is a crisis every time it comes up in Washington, D.C. And building for cars, building sprawl has caused many cities to go bankrupt. It's hard to overstate. And it's also sort of one of those hidden in plain sight realities where we kind of see the way we live is so normal that it's hard to imagine that it's not actually working, but it's not.
You had another edition in 2018. Would you have anything to add if you put another one out in 2024 today?
Yeah, you know, like, I think I squeezed bike share a little bit into the 2018 edition, but I would probably focus a lot more on bike share today. I would also, I mean, I feel like our politics in the US have gotten so weird lately that might affect it. Like, I think it's just a more hostile environment politically for kind of getting anything done that is not related to big money, big business. One of the things that I really most enjoyed writing about in Bikenomics is just kind of the like amazing initiatives that different groups came up with, whether it's like a group of people that, you know, are leading, you know, bike tours of their city, supporting local businesses, to kind of building affinity groups, building identity-based groups. And there's just so much more of that now. And everyone I wrote about in the original two editions is amazing. And now there's like so many more people doing amazing things. So if I were to do another edition, I would probably go a little wild with profiling people whose work I just find so inspiring.
Yeah. People have found a lot of ways, different associations that they can organize rides around, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think the Radical Adventure Riders was a group that I learned about probably right before the pandemic, I think 2019. And they have chapters all over the country, and they're making bike adventures and bike touring more accessible and also just like super fun. And it's a super inclusive and smart group. They have publications, they have good graphic design. I think that matters. So yeah, groups like that. And then like the Cyclista zine out of New York, I love. There's amazing things springing up all the time. More than I hear about. I'm a little bit out of the loop, but I do always have my eye out. So I hope people email me and tell me about cool things that they see happening in their community.
Well, you're at Microcosm Publishing, so I don't know if you're completely out of the loop, and you just published two anthologies about feminist bicycle science fiction.
Yeah, so I started publishing a feminist bicycle zine in, I think, 2010, 2011. For the 10th issue, I had a whim. I was like, I'll do a science fiction themed issue and have people write science fiction stories that are about feminism and bikes. And that just seemed like such a funny trio of factors, but I got a lot of stories and they were really good. And I got enough that I was like, I guess I'll do this every year. And I just put out the 10th and the 11th one. I had two come out this year. They both have sort of a book, extra theme of books. So it's like feminist, bicycle, sci-fi, and fantasy stories about books and about books. And it's just a ton of fun. Like I get contributors just kind of come out of the woodwork, tons of cold submissions, people getting really into the prompt. And I like it because it's like sort of makes you imagine the future and whether that's a dystopian future or a utopian future. It involves bikes because it has to for the theme. And it's so cool to see what people come up with. They come up with the damnedest things.
You're doing what people do with rides, which is you make connections between the different things that you care about or love and biking.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure that's like a huge source of inspiration for these creative projects that I do also. Yeah. As like being involved in sort of the bike fun movement in Portland, and bicycling has everything to do with tacos and pizza. You just have to bike around and do those things.
Biking is just a way to connect places.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're in Portland at Microcosm. How has things changed in the time you've been putting out books?
Oh, man.
For biking.
That's hard. I mean, Portland has changed a lot. You probably have seen us on television as being this like war zone since the summer of 2020, which is like weirdly not true. I mean, there was a lot of activism in Portland that year. A lot of it was confined to like kind of one square block downtown, but like we had friends calling us and they're like, I saw on the news that Portland is just overrun with rioters. And, you know, I would be like sitting on my front porch, like complete silence all around me and being like, oh yeah, sure. Portland's reputation has changed a lot. Like when I first moved here in the late 90s, it was like this very sort of like gritty artsy place where you could go and not pay a lot of money for rent. And it was this DIY arts renaissance, which was amazing. By 2008, the bike boom and this sort of like gentrification boom had gone hand in hand. And a lot of people were moving here for sort of like the quality of life and the like green spaces. And unfortunately, most of them brought their cars and brought their sort of expectations from elsewhere. And that really transformed the city. Like it's definitely a much more expensive place than it used to be. A lot of longtime residents and communities have been pushed out to the margins or just pushed out of town entirely. And then, yeah, of course, the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement of 2020-2021 kind of caused a lot of the people who had come for the quality of life to leave again. And the city is kind of finding a new equilibrium. We're a little bit less sexy in the media, which I think is honestly good. There's still a lot of amazing people living here doing incredible things. It's still fairly expensive, but the inflation has like maybe paused or tapered off a little bit. It's not up to Seattle or San Francisco level, though it is like possibly comparable to like New York. It's gone through a lot of transitions, which is all a rambling way of answering your question. I'm not sure if that does. And I mean, as far as what's changed for bicycling, like it is not as much sort of like the golden era of bikes as it was in 2008, 2010. But, you know, the city has continued to slowly and steadily build out bike infrastructure. Being less in the spotlight is probably making it a little bit easier for them to just like do it. It's never as fast as anyone wants. It's not as fast as I want, but it's happening. And ridership has gone down somewhat, but like there's a biking school bus that leaves from in front of my house every Wednesday morning. There's everywhere you go, if you're on a bike path, there's a ton of cyclists. So there's a lot of people sort of decrying how Portland has become much worse, but I'm not totally seeing it.
It's known as the bike city, right? Or the bike city? Or
it had a reputation for a while as like one of the best cities for biking in North America, which I don't know if that's true. I think Montreal is better. Other cities have definitely done more. Portland definitely cornered the market on the appearance of being very bike friendly. They cornered the public relations market on that.
What were you thinking when you said that you would mention bike share when it comes to bikeonomics?
Oh, I mean, just that like in 2012, bike share wasn't really, it was very marginal. It only existed in a few cities. It wasn't really a thing. And just now it's like just about every city you go to in the world has a bike share program. You can just go to any city and rent a bike, sometimes an electric bike, and ride for short trips. And it is, I think, very transformative. I go to Vegas for a trade show once or twice a year, and just being able to ride bike share around Las Vegas, it turns it from a terrible city to an amazing city. And, you know, there's only a small area of town where it operates, but it really like, it opens it up. It made me like really appreciate and love going there when previously I had dreaded that and hated it. So it's a bringer of joy and creator of connections.
Again, that word. Feminist bicycle science fiction. When did they come out, the anthologies?
Oh, great question. Okay, so we have A Bicyclist's Guide to the Galaxy, which is the first of the book-themed ones. And that one came out in December 2023. And then the newest one is called Bikes, the Universe, and Everything. Maybe you get the theme. And that one comes out in May. And people can find them at bikesinspace.com or microcosmpublishing.com, and then search for Bikes in Space and you'll find them.
So who came up with the Douglas Adams titles?
I did. Finding titles for them is very difficult, and those ones seemed pretty fun to me. My original goal was to have the two covers, like you could put them side by side and it would create one continuous image, but the cover designer was not into that. So I really like the way the covers turned out, though. They have sort of like 80s Trapper Keeper, early 90s Trapper Keeper type color looking covers on them. And yeah, they're a lot of fun. And you want to read feminist stories about how the world is or could be. I think you could do a lot worse than to pick up one of these books and giggle and read your way through an evening. The stories are really good. That's the other thing, is like when I first started, I used to have to do a ton of editorial work. Like I'd get stories in various levels of how polished they were, like a lot of really high quality stories. But now I like get to be choosy, and it's wild to have that available. So really, really good stories. And I think I've gotten better at editing them too.
And you're able to get a lot of submissions?
Yeah, I get like 40 to 60 submissions for each anthology, and I publish like 10 to 12. So I hope what's happening is when I reject a story that people are out there submitting it to other markets, and that we're seeding the world with feminist bicycle science fiction and fantasy. I've seen a couple of them. I've seen a couple stories turn up in other markets.
So future generations will say, what was going on that there was this genre?
Exactly. Or it won't even be a genre. It'll just be normal. You're like, oh, I'm writing science fiction. It needs a bicycle. It needs to be feminist.
It's the only kind there will be.
Exactly.
So, how about a reading?
All right. I'm going to read part of a story that I wrote for The Bicyclist's Guide to the Galaxy. The story is called Goblin Supermarket by Ellie Blue. I stare at the blinking cursor on my screen. Do I fix the commas, cut the adverb, cut the whole paragraph, kill this terrible story episode deader than Clamor's cartoonish enemies? I decide to go for a bike ride instead to clear my head and get a sandwich. Wheels whirring, muscles working, I navigate traffic lights, cars, dog walkers, potholes, puddles. My senses alert, I'm grateful for the realness of the world I inhabit when I'm not churning out content for the Nightland serialized fiction app. Someone's behind me in the bike lane, so I stand on the pedals to give myself more power coming out of a red light. Sure, I get a little competitive. There aren't a lot of parts of my life where I feel like a winner, but here on the road, I love the virtuoso feeling of balance and speed, body and bike working together. I peek in my handlebar mirror and glimpse an upright posture and the kind of derpy bike that usually has a couple kids on the back. I refocus on the road ahead and let some thoughts about Clamor the Avengers' upcoming adventures creep into my mind. It's time for a sex scene, according to the Nightlands formula. Maybe Clamor will take a wounded enemy from the battlefield as a hostage, but it'll be a really sexy enemy with a surface wound on his broad chest that needs to be carefully cleaned and bandaged. Whoosh! I nearly topple as a collection of shapes and colors materializes beside me in the lane, far too close. Regaining my balance, I see the mom bike I thought I'd left in my dust a block ago pulling ahead with the telltale whir of an electric assist. Cheater, I grumble at the retreating ponytail. She's not moving as fast as I'd thought and turns to look just as I flip her the bird. Her eyebrows go up and her hand does too in an exaggerated wave as she clumsily shifts gears and zooms off, pedaling hard and getting far too much forward momentum out of the effort. The rage swells in me for a moment, and then I see the tiny kid-sized helmet strapped to the empty child seat on the back. That brings me right back down, feeling like enough of an asshole that I don't bother trying to catch up. This is low blood sugar in action, I tell myself. It was a good call to break for lunch. I take the final 10 blocks easy, waving cars past me at stop signs, aggressively looking to not pick a fight. But because my life is a bad joke, she's there, locking up at the sole rack outside of PDX Veg. There's already one bike on the rack, and she's struggling to maneuver her giant, stupid SUV of a bike into a position where her U-lock will fit around both the staple and her bike's tank-like frame. I sigh loudly, then make a big production of locking my trusty steel frame 10-speed to the fence around the restaurant's recycling bins. Part of me is rolling my eyes hard at myself, another part is genuinely annoyed by this poser, and a third is just thinking about the sandwich I'm about to order and the cookie I'm going to inhale while I wait for it. I'm going to stop reading there. But
cool.
Things happen both in the story and in the story within the story. So
that is very cool. Can you tell me how they tie into the feminist and science fiction themes?
Sure, yeah. This is like kind of more experimental, loosely science fiction, like both of the characters in the story, the two bicyclists who are about to meet and surprisingly get along with each other. They're both fantasy writers, and their stories that they're writing kind of play a part in the narrative as it unfolds. It's not like thoroughly in a science fiction world or a fantasy world, but it like has the interplay of these two fantasy worlds in it. It was super fun to write. And then, of course, I'm the person who rides the like electric assist mom bike. So I thought it was kind of fun to have a main character who didn't like that and made fun of it, but they do come around in the end, spoiler alert. And then for the next book, The Bikes, the Universe, and Everything, I wrote a sequel. It's the same characters 15 or 20 years later after a sort of unnamed apocalypse, and they are living in a split to us as speculative fiction world, and to them is just like their new life that they're trying to navigate. So I wanted to tie the two stories together to help tie the two volumes together.
And how many stories are in there?
There's 10 in The Bicyclist's Guide to the Galaxy, and there's actually 15 in Bikes, the Universe, and Everything. I divided it by longer stories and shorter stories, which is a little bit arbitrary, but it worked.
Are there pictures?
There's one comic in Bikes, the Universe, and Everything, but other than the covers, there's not pictures in the rest. Do you think it would be better if there were pictures? Do you want pictures? Market research.
I have a kid, and I guess I'm thinking in terms of pictures. But
oh, interesting. Yeah, these seem like they would be for kids, but they're not. It's usually pretty like adult themes. I mean, it's usually not like inappropriate for kids, but I think it would be like pretty boring for a kid. Mid-teens and up would be right for this.
I just think it would be cool to see some pictures.
I know. I love books with pictures in it, too. Wasn't in the cards for this one, but yeah.
We can get these online and
order it from any bookstore. You can order it from microcosm.pub. You can get it wherever books are sold, though I always encourage people to go to their independent bookstore, their local library, or directly to the publisher or author just to help keep the book ecosystem strong.
Thank you, Ellie Blue, for keeping the flame of literacy and biking alive.
Thanks. Important. Oh, can I tell you about two other bike books we published that are nonfiction in case people aren't into the sci-fi? We republished Major Taylor's autobiography. He was like a famous bicycle racer of the 1800s. And he was the first African-American athlete to be a world champion. And it's kind of a superstar global celebrity sports figure. His autobiography is so fun to read. It was just really cool to be able to publish it. It's called The Fastest Bicycle Rider in the World. We also recently published April Streeter's book, Women on Wheels, which is a nonfiction historical survey of women bicycling. It is not academic at all. It is super fun to read. She has these like really great profiles of a ton of historical women cyclists from all over the world. Her specialty is talking about fashion, so it's like really fun. You can read about what they wore, which is always super colorful in more ways than one. And then also she talks about kind of like how they fit into their historical times. And yeah, it's called Women on Wheels. It's a really fun book and a great book to inspire the cyclist in your life.
So it's all at microcosm.pub. Well, thanks, Ellie, for being on Bike Talk again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Nick. It's always a pleasure.
Well, Nick, that adds a lot of new books to our bookshop site at biketalk.org.
Four new books, the April Streeter biography, the Major Taylor biography, and two anthologies of feminist bicycle science fiction.
I've read a couple of biographies about Major Taylor, and I can tell you they are very much worth the read. Yeah. Next week on the show, we have Peter Flax, who has just written the book Live to Ride, Finding Joy in Meeting on a Bicycle. And for those who don't know, Peter was the editor of Bicycling Magazine for many years and is now a journalist and author living in Los Angeles.
And now one last interview on a ride that happened in Springfield, Massachusetts last weekend. What was the event that you went to this weekend?
Bike Life Ride Out in Springfield. It's like when a group of bikers from all around the city and world get together and they just go out and roam the streets. Bike life. Pop willies. It's unique. It's unique around the world.
And how many of these you been to? You been to these before?
Yeah, I've been to a few with me and my friends.
You've been to them too?
Yeah, it was pretty fun. It's a little chaotic when it was like really crowded with all the bikes around.
You managed to get in and out among all the other bikes?
Yeah, but it was like still kind of difficult trying to.
How many other riders were there?
268 around there.
And how far did you go?
We went all around. We took over, there's like some small like little highway. You could go to Holyoke. We went around the whole entire Springfield. We just went around. The host, he already had the route planned.
Does this host do other events, like has done other of these before?
Yeah, plenty.
So it was a known thing. You knew what to expect coming into it?
Everyone knows what they're getting themselves into before coming to one of these.
What else do you do in there besides wheelies? You do wheelies, you ride around, you rode on a highway, like an actual highway?
It was a highway, but not a busy highway. Yeah, it's always good to go on bike life meets. You can meet new people, popping wheelies, stuff like that. It's pretty fun. Stuff got a little bit chaotic. There was a guy swerving on a bike. He was popping a wheelie, swerving, and the car just ran him over. Everyone stopped. Picked the bike up. The bike was folded in half, so no more SC bike for him. He was all right. It was just like his arm and legs, but he walked it off.
That wasn't like a road rage incident, was it? Did they mean to hit this guy?
Not really. He was on he was swerving on his bike, so he basically asked for it. The car couldn't stop because there was cars behind him, so it was either he braked and would have got hit and would have caused a bigger incident, or it would have just kept going and hit the biker. It would have never caused that much of a big incident.
There were no other issues, or there was?
When we ride around in a huge, huge group. There was a car in front of us, kept brake checking us, and then one of the bikers took out a gun on him, and then the car just sped off.
Well, that would do it, I guess. That would take care of a driver brake checking. Brake checking is when you get in front of the rider and slam your brakes.
Pretty dangerous. Could get a lot of the bikers injured.
So about these SE bikes, was everybody on this type of bike?
Yeah, and if they're not on a SE bike, they're probably like on a mafia bike or like a mountain bike that's built for wheeling. That's like an SE bike that has SE parts in it.
So it's a whole subculture kind of thing where everybody's riding the same kind of bike.
Yeah, we're like all family.
And you do anything between bike rides together, or is it you just mainly see each other on bike rides?
Sometimes we go out and eat.
Sometimes to like the school corner store or something.
On your bikes?
Yeah, or to school too.
You have like social media?
Yeah, there's a main page of the meets. They post where the location's gonna be at, where's the meeting spot, what time we're leaving at, what time it starts, what time it ends.
Once again, what's it called?
Bike Life Rideouts.
Thank you for your report back. That's the end of the show. Thanks, Taylor. Thanks, Anne-Marie.
Thanks to Charles. And thanks to Rio.
Thanks, Ellie Blue. Thanks to the listeners.
Good night, John Boy.
Nobody knows John Boy. I know John Boy, but I bet
Anne-Marie. Come on, everybody knows John Boy. Anne-Marie, do you know who that is?
No.
Sorry, Taylor.
Oh, my God.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Mama. Good night, Ben.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, Mama.
Good night, Daddy.
Good night, children.
Good night, Daddy. Good night, Elizabeth.
Good night, John Boy. Good night, Jim Bob. Good night, Jim Bob.
Good night, Jim Bob.
What's going on? I was asleep. What's everybody doing?
Good night.
Good night, Jim Bob.
Go back to sleep.
Nick, are we old or what?
It was old when I was watching old reruns when I was a kid. How about a bike quote?
Work to eat, eat to live, live to ride, ride to work.
See y'all next week.
Ride safe, everybody.
Hi, this is Stacy with a bike thought. It was a beautiful sunny day in San Francisco. Matilda and Diego were going to the zoo with their two baby boys, 18 and 3 months old. It was their third wedding anniversary. They were waiting at the bus stop by the library and the West Portal Transit Center when a 78-year-old woman drove her Mercedes-Benz SUV into them. Witnesses say she was on the wrong side of the road and traveling at speeds of 50 to 70 miles per hour in this quiet residential neighborhood. She got out of her car, dazed and confused, but physically fine. There were no skid marks on the ground. Matilda and Diego's son Joaquin was found 60 feet from the bus stop. Diego was found 80 feet away. Both were dead. Matilda and her infant, clinging to life, were rushed to the hospital. Hours later, Matilda was pronounced dead. Their orphan child, who will never remember the love of his parents and brother, remains in the hospital, critically wounded. There is not one thing that will solve this uniquely American problem that keeps playing out over and over and over again. We must instead employ everything to stop car dominance and the slaughter of innocents. This episode of Bike Talk is sponsored by the law offices of Pocras and De Los Reyes, with offices in Los Angeles and Bakersfield and serving all of Southern California.
And that was Bike Talk. If you have a story, a tip, or a topic, head over to biketalk.org and send us a message. Talk again next week.
Get on your bike, sit on the seat, put your feet on the pedals, and ride it all around, ride it all around. Oh, get that car out of my way. I want to ride my bike today. Keep me fit, get me there. I won't go stinking out the air. Leave behind the daily grind. Let your mind unwind. Live its life, pretend to life. Better get yourself a bike. Get yourself a bike. Oh, get yourself a bike.